listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY
Musician
Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 220 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how are you?
I'm great. I'm a little bit overwhelmed with something that pertains to the discussion we're going to have today.
Oh, really?
The discussion being about cover songs. And the reason I'm overwhelmed is in November, I have several different kinds of cover song gigs that I'm about to do where I need... the first one, I need to know three songs from the 90s. And then the next one, I have to learn 14 songs by Frightened Rabbit, which is, it's a tribute to Frightened Rabbit's kind of main songwriter, singer, who committed suicide earlier this year. And anyway, so we're playing a bunch of his songs. And then later in the month, I'm going to do one of those 3 or 4 hour marathon, like bar gigs where like 75% of the stuff I'm doing is all covers.
Wow.
So
well,
I need to learn a lot of songs this month.
This conversation is very timely then, because like you said, we are going to be talking about cover songs and the right way to do cover songs. So yeah, that's perfect. Perfect.
And amidst all that, just to clear the palette of cover songs, I have a couple showcases at NERFA, the Northeast Folk Conference, where I'll be playing my own stuff. So that'll be like the little breath of fresh air I get amongst all these songs by other people.
Interesting. Well, I think you will have a fresh perspective on this discussion. And I've got something to bring to the table as well that we'll discuss when we get to that, that just happened recently. A few discussions with artists, and then in my own band, relating to cover songs. And so, yeah, we'll be talking about that. But before we go into all that, this is, Chris, the very last podcast I will be recording at the current CD Baby HQ.
Aww.
Yeah. We've been in this building 7 years. We're moving on to greener pastures just down the road. We're on Airport Way now. We're still going to be basically on Airport Way. But when you fly into Portland, Oregon, when you leave the airport, there's this big shopping area and business park with an IKEA. We're going to be right there. So you'll even see the CD Baby sign on the building as you drive by.
You'll fly right overhead.
That's true. My desk is right by the window. And when I'm bored at work, I can just watch the planes land, because... it's the building is like 300 yards from the end of the runway. So they're really low. It's like you can almost reach up and touch them. We'll be recording in a new location.
Yeah. And when we get around to doing an episode in the new location, we should do something about new chapters in your musical career, or new ways to think about something, or something about newness.
Yeah. Or oldness or newness. Oh. Yes.
Out with the old, in with the new.
So yes, this is the last recording that I'm going to be doing in this bare-walled white room, the office. We're a couple days away from moving day. So it looks like that last day in the college dorms where everyone's got all their crap out in the hallway and they're hoping that they can just exit the building and not have to take it out with them and that someone else will deal with it. That's what the whole place looks like. And the interesting thing, Chris, I didn't even have to ask. They put a whole soundproof podcast room in this new location for me.
That's amazing.
That's the kind of pull I have these days.
Nice. Well, the most important question I have is, has anyone taken down the dolphin that hangs from our ceiling?
It's gone. Long gone.
And is there plans to move it to the new location?
No plans. The new location is quite a step up from where we've been. This isn't everyone go buy random furniture from IKEA anymore. There's even some little architectural interests that have been added to the place. It looks very nice. Very nice. So we'll post some photos once we move in. It's running a little behind schedule. So a lot of like the design detail and painting and murals and stuff that are going to get added won't be there when we move in, but they will be later. But yeah, I'm excited. And the funny thing was, I was here at work yesterday and someone messaged me from the office and like, oh, just wondering when I can come by and get your lamp, because they auctioned off all the furniture. Like employees could get it for free, but it was just like a lottery. And so, yeah, like I'm standing here working and people are coming in taking all my stuff.
It's like, I feel like that's a scene in a movie.
It felt like one. I feel like, yeah, it's just interesting. So yeah, a lot of change happening. Oh, and this is all happening the same week that Small Town Poets, the guys are coming into town. We're doing some shows here in the Northwest. And this had been planned like 9 months ago. And then when we were talking about CD Baby moving and like, it's going to be in August. Well, it looks like it's September. Well, it could be the beginning of October. I'm like, you know what? It's going to be that exact same week when I was planning on taking the entire week off to go do shows all week. So having to manage a lot and basically play a concert promoter on one of the shows as well. So a lot going on.
It's crazy. And you said they're flying in tonight?
Yep. Yep. And rehearse tomorrow, do the show and, you know, trying to make good of it. We got a nice venue. I hired a lighting guy, got a video and photographer coming. So trying to make it useful and get good photos while we're playing shows. We're playing with a band in Seattle that is much, much, much bigger following than us. And I'm hoping that goes well. And it's a packed show and all that. So we'll see. If anything, we'll be making memories.
Yeah, well, I'll see some of those memories on Instagram.
That's right. If you want to see what's going on this week, follow Small Town Poets on Instagram, just at Small Town Poets. And you should follow Chris at Chris Robley. And you should follow me at Kay Bruner. And then you'll get to see everything we're doing. And you will find, if I can get this edited fast enough, you will find a picture of our last podcast from this building. Chris could be in Mexico for all I know. I don't know where Chris records these things. You could be on a beach somewhere.
I'm trying to think if I've ever been on the... You know, I've been close to a beach when we've recorded one of these before.
As long as you haven't done it from the bathroom.
Never on the beach, right. No, I've not done that yet.
All right. Well,
but longtime listeners know that I have recorded one in my underwear before because it was so damn hot.
That's true. You did do that.
I had no AC on my office.
Yeah. Before we get into the topic at hand, I want to remind everybody that right now we have $29 album submissions going, and you can also get $20 off a pro album submission. It's the time to get your music out there. Head over to cdbaby.com/promo. Get your music up. Start planning your show.co marketing campaigns and your Spotify pre-save campaigns. The season is upon us. Lots of people consuming music, getting new devices, lots of Alexas and Google Voices, I'm sure, this year, and Apple-enabled speakers. People are going to be trying things out, listening to more music, and you want your music out there. So yeah, $29 album submissions. Head on over to cdbaby.com/promo to get the coupon codes and all the details. All right.
And not only should you use that deal right now, but when you sign up your music, you want to get that to us as fast as possible, because a lot of the digital music services go on pretty long vacations during Thanksgiving and Christmas. So if you want it up in time for the holidays, now's the time.
How nice of them. It's nice that people get vacations.
I know. So novel.
All right. So today we're going to be talking about cover songs. And this is one where I'm hoping we get a lot of emails and calls about, because it seems to be a polarizing topic. And how this came about is I was at some point, some location in the world. I won't disclose it because I don't want anyone to think I'm throwing them under the bus. But I was with some artists, and somebody said, I mentioned the idea of using cover songs to help build an audience. And the reaction I got was I wouldn't say shocking. It was surprising. It really infuriated them. And they sort of got on a soapbox and got kind of mad at me. And this was in front of a group of like 50 people. I was, I think, 3 vodka sodas in at that point. So I just found the whole thing entertaining and stood there graciously while I got reamed in front of all these people for mentioning cover songs. So that kind of stuck with me. Like, wow, people really still struggle with the idea of a cover song equaling being in a wedding band. And so that was one thing that happened. And
not that there's anything wrong with being in a wedding band.
No, in fact, I think I'm going to start looking for a wedding band to be in, because Why not? But you would concur that there's been sort of this negative connotation towards the idea of a wedding band. Would you agree with me?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. I would. I was just trying to make wedding band people feel a little bit better if they were feeling criticized.
No, there. I have no problem with
some
it.
Some of the absolute best musicians I've ever known are in wedding bands.
That's just been like that person's reaction to me was like that's what they were basically. I was basically telling them to go be in a wedding band. That's kind of what the characterization of it was. But then recently, I just was talking about Small Town Poets doing some shows. We were talking about one of the potential covers that we could be doing for that gig that we're doing in Seattle, where we're opening for someone else who has an audience that's not going to be familiar with our music. And some ideas were thrown out. And my comment was, those just feel random. There's no connection to us. It's like, yeah, sure, they might know that very popular song, but it doesn't feel like it has any context to us or that audience. It's just like playing a hit song randomly. So my feedback was, I don't think that's going to do what we're going to do. I don't think that's going to do what we would hope in that situation. And so those two things happened recently. And I thought we haven't talked about cover songs in a long time, and really going through like all the strategies and how you can use a cover song, the right way to do cover songs, maybe a few wrong ways to do cover songs. But just they're so powerful, and we see them really elevate artists' careers all the time here at CD Baby. And so we're going to talk about that today.
Yeah, and I just have a comment for people. Like, I know a lot of songwriter friends who have that mentality of like, that is totally beneath me. If I do a cover song, I'm pandering to some sort of like least common denominator aspect of my audience and blah, blah, blah. And like, then they like cite, you know, the artistic purity of all these great songwriters. And I'm like, yeah, you're kind of forgetting the fact that like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones' first few albums have tons of covers. And like Radiohead did a Carly Simon cover, and Sonic Youth did like a Carpenters cover, and, you know, Nirvana's Unplugged album is a bunch. Like, everyone has done covers.
Guns
like,
N' Roses have done covers.
Guns N' Roses. Yeah, like anyone you hold up as a sort of songwriting icon has it. I mean, David Bowie did an entire album of covers, at least. I think he might have done two of them.
You mentioned the Beatles.
To get over yourself, basically.
For one time when I was doing a talking at some conference, I actually looked up how many cover songs the Beatles have done, and they've done over 50. And I was like, whoa. I could think of like, oh, they've probably done 10, but they've done over 50. Cover songs.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that's how they learned. Bruce Springsteen's another example. I don't know if he released cover songs, but he's, you know, kind of on record as saying the only reason he has a career is because his band early on learned, you know, hour upon hour of other people's music and learned how to kind of become good as a band and good as arrangers and all that stuff. And so, yeah.
Yeah. So, until you've,
and we're not asking you to do 7 hours of covers, maybe just one cover.
But we have some specific strategies and ways to think about that we're going to talk about. The first thing I would say is the one thing that really got me thinking about cover songs in a different way. And Chris, I think I was actually watching you play at Al's Den here in Portland. And I think that's when I told you that you needed to write a pop song, just like, what's your face?
Katy Perry.
Katy Perry. Because I'm like, you need to write a song that's like that because it fits you, but you don't, you know. Anyway, but what I was thinking is like that venue that you were playing at was a venue where it's in a hotel. There's people that go there to hang out and have drinks and know there's music, but a lot of people from the hotel are drifting in and out. And when you played the Katy Perry song, and I see the nature of the audience change, their attention changed, their demeanor, everything changed. And then they were really into you. And I thought what's happening with a cover song is like, it's a musical language that the people in the audience already know. And so you're putting your spin on it. So they aren't sitting there trying to figure out, okay, do I like this song? You know, is it catchy? Is it good? Or am I connecting with this song? and then trying to figure out whether or not they like your sound on top of that, they instantly get the song. And so now they know the song. It's something they know already. And so they are understanding you better as an artist and have quicker access to understand who you are as an artist. And to me, that's what really, like, it's that you're speaking a language they already know. And so there's one less thing that their brain's sitting there trying to figure out. And it's gone from being in, I'm trying to figure out this song, what are the words, do I like it, to I know this and I like what they're doing. And so it opens them up to just accepting you as an artist for what you do. And that's why I think covers are important.
I think in a way it's an invitation, but it's also like, along with that invitation, you're giving them permission to, like, you know, like, as you're saying, sort of engage with the rest of your stuff. But sometimes I notice that when I play covers, I'm also giving them permission to acknowledge that they like the song in the first place. Cause, like, I've had so many people be like, oh, I hate that song by Paul McCartney, or I've always hated that song until I heard you do it. Now I actually kind of think it's a good song. Or the same thing with the Katy Perry. Like, so many, like, hipsters would never be like, oh, I like that song. But then they see some indie rock band doing it, and they're like, oh yeah, that's actually a catchy song. It's funny how you can almost change people's tastes retroactively if you just do something familiar.
Yeah, and that wasn't on my list, but I think that's a good addition to what I have here on my list, is the idea that, well, you're bringing to light a song. I think that's happened a lot with Bob Dylan. Frankly, I don't really care for a lot of Bob Dylan's versions of his own songs, but then other people do them, and I really love them. And I think it's a way that you can connect artistic worlds. Like, you almost become a curator and a tastemaker in that sense, because it's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's like you're putting your stamp of approval on it as an artist, and then that has some sort of cachet to the listener, or with the listener.
Absolutely. And actually, you know, you mentioned the Beatles. I think with some of the early stuff, that's absolutely what they did. They took R&B songs that had some popularity, but they exploded them to much larger audiences. And
right.
So all right, so I've got a list here, and, you know, we'll be a little more freeform in this conversation just because there's lots of interesting angles. But one of the first things I wrote down is like a strategy, or why you should think about doing cover songs, or how you can use a cover song, is by using it to give context to your story as an artist. And by that, I mean an influence, which we were sort of just talking about, or a region where you're from and there's a particular sound. And an example that I had from what we've done with Small Town Poets is we have a song called If You'll Let Me Love You. And it's about, you know, being there for somebody, not having words to know how to, like, make it right, but just being there for them for that bummer of a moment. And so we tagged on the front of it, Everybody Hurts by REM, who we got compared to a lot, but they were also a Georgia band, and that song was huge. So, and it lyrically tied to the song we were about to play. So it was kind of one of those things where not only did it introduce the song, I mean, because If You Let Me Love You was the song of ours that went number one, it took this really popular song that everybody knew, especially at that time. They're another Georgia band. There's that connection, and lyrically it matched up. So when we went into the song If You Let Me Love You, it just kind of, like, catapulted it into it. And it was like, we used something that they already knew to really set up and introduce the song that our fans were waiting for. And so that was like, it drew people into the story of the song and into the story of us as a band.
Yeah. And I hosted a house concert here a couple weeks ago, and one of the songwriters did an original song that was about a relationship they'd had, this woman had had with this Irish guy, who lived, you know, across the Atlantic. And the whole time I'm listening to the song, I'm like, those chord changes are really familiar. And, you know, she keeps talking about this guy from Ireland and, like, his, you know, various aspects of their story. And then I suddenly realized, I'm like, oh, this is With or Without You, like, what the chords are from. So then at some point she went into With or Without You and played about a minute or minute and a half of it, and then went back into her song. So that was, like, another way in which you can kind of bring a cover song into your own, you know, bolster your own thing by referencing someone else's.
I love it when people do that. That gets me every time, unless it's a terrible song choice. But
no, and in this, like, it totally worked. It was like, by the time she started singing it, everyone, I think, had like started to expect it. So it was gratifying in that way, too.
Yeah. Were there tears?
Not in that song, but there were tears for it was a beautiful house concert. It was super moving.
All right. The next point I have, or the next strategy around using a cover song that I have, is using it for a missing moment in your set or album. I think a lot of times what people are missing in their set, their live set, is that fun moment where things break out a little bit more, it gets looser, maybe there's a little bit more soloing around the different instruments on the stage, and that's a way to use a cover song. I know Tom Jackson's big on those, you know, having that fun moment. I think he always likes to put it like 3/4 of the way into the set, where now it's just getting loose, where everyone's just having a good time.
That was the Katy Perry song for me. I mean, I like that song, but it also is like, okay, I've got all this sort of fairly serious and angular, whatever, indie pop stuff. I'm like, I need something a little bit teen abandon joy kind of thing. Katy Perry.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah. And I think with a lot of the music that's out there right now, that's probably the one in the live set that tends to be missing something more fun. There, you know, if you go back into the era of like the 80s, I would say it might be the opposite. But yeah, you could also be like, maybe your band is really upbeat and high energy, but you don't have any of those, like a lower ballad or mellow moment in the set. And so your fans just kind of, especially when you start playing longer shows, it's like, I need a break. Let this all process, you know, bring it down for a few minutes, you know? So that could be a possibility as well. For us, we've done this multiple times, but in the show we did recently in Atlanta, we have a song on a new album that has horns. And so we had a live horn section for that song. And we thought, well, that's kind of a bummer to bring them up on stage just for that one song. Let's keep them. We had threw a cover song in the set, Down on the Corner, which Southern rock, which goes to the roots of the guys in the band coming from a small town in Georgia. And so we had those guys stay on the stage, the horn guys, and we just added a bunch of solo sections in the middle of the song and let them solo each time around and introduced them, because we had these amazing horn guys. Let's let them play. And that was really the moment in the set where it just got loose and fun, people just goofing off on stage, and that's how we used it. The other way we did was like in this sort of big, like giving the audience permission to just have fun from that point on, was that 70s medley that we've used in the show.co campaign, where it was a medley of 70s of seven songs from the 70s. And, you know, it had Message in a Bottle, More Than a Feeling, Listen to the Music, a little Black Dog in there. I'm trying to think what else. Don't Bring Me Down. I love that part. That was a good part. Good old ELO in there. So by the time that was done, it lasted like 10 minutes. By that time, the room, everyone was sweaty and just having a great time. And if you were still standing there with your arms crossed, you probably hated music to begin with. So that's why we used it. At that point on, I would always say to the guys, after that point, we could do whatever we want on stage. It wouldn't matter, because we had them at that point. And so that's kind of a way of using it for that missing moment. Like if you need a bigger fun section, or just a section where people can break out and play and show that they're good at their instrument, or a ballad or whatnot.
Yeah. And I think if you're choosing your cover songs through contrast in that way, it helps if you're the type of band or artist that knows quite a few cover songs, so that as your original set changes, you know, assuming you're not playing the exact same 45 or hour and a half or whatever you're doing, you have a few cover songs in your repertoire that can, you know, maybe you're doing a little bit more of your fun originals, so you do a ballad that's a cover, or if you're doing your more serious original stuff, you get the fun cover. So,
well, and actually
learn a bunch of stuff.
I have a question for you, because when you were talking about that, and when you were talking about what something you said at the top of the show about, I was wondering if you ever start changing out covers to adapt to what's happening with the audience there. Like, you know what? It would probably be good to pull out this cover right now because I'm losing them or I have them. And so I'm going to just take it over the top with this thing.
Totally. So I try to hold enough of the, I wouldn't say I'm ever like at a lot. How do I phrase this? Like the things that I keep in reserve for those moments are always the upbeat, fun, dancey pop songs that everyone knows. It's like, I don't need to hold like a slow Bob Dylan song in reserve for anything. It's like, that's the stuff people want to just get through or eat dinner through or whatever. So yeah, I try to have like, you know, a good smattering of those songs through the set. And then if I need more of them, I always have them because there will be times when, you know, if I'm playing a cover song gig, like, okay, it's 11 o'clock and now all the college crowd just came in and they're dancing. Like, I don't want to go back to the slow stuff then. Like, I need another hour of the dance stuff. So yeah, I try to definitely learn enough of it so that I've got, you know, 5 hours of stuff in my brain and then I can pick and choose in the moment.
I can barely keep an hour's worth of stuff in my brain.
Yeah. Well, it's the interesting thing with a lot of pop songs is you don't actually have to learn all the verses because most people never know like that you just repeated the same verse two or three times.
Ah.
Because people don't really care about the verse lyrics. They just want to sing the chorus. So that's one little cheat that I have. Like I never, I mean, some songs it's integral if it's a narrative, but if it's something like I Can't Feel My Face,
why does Chris,
it doesn't matter if you sing the same
Chris
verse
has sung
three
the
times.
Same verse three times. What's his problem?
That's like, it's part of my brain storage technique.
Good tip. See, we're learning tips. Both of us are learning. let's see. What do I have next? Oh, we've been talking a lot about the live stuff, which cover songs tend to be a useful tool in the live setting. But some of it doesn't necessarily pertain to live, some of the strategy we're going to talk about. I saw you made a note of like, if there's, you want to make a statement, like there's a protest song or a song that ties into a particular issue that you're passionate about as an artist, that could be a good way to use a cover song.
Yeah. And I've been thinking a lot about Mary Gaucher's newer album and like Bruce Springsteen's Ghost of Tom Joad album. They're full of like these really sort of human tales, but they also serve as protest songs. And that's kind of the mode I've been in my own writing. So I've found myself covering a lot of that
I've
stuff.
I've noticed on Instagram.
Then what happens is I end up, if I've written a bunch of songs of my own in that mode, when it comes time to do the cover, I'm like, all right, I just did 8 protest songs. Like I don't necessarily go and do another Bruce Springsteen one. Like that's the time for Katy Perry. But it's good to know them though, and you can work them in when need be.
Or yeah, or if it's just like somebody's written a song where you're like, that's exactly what I want to say right now. That's a good way to think about using a cover song. It's like maybe you're feeling stuff about, you know, a relationship or the state of the world or whatever. It doesn't have to be necessarily politically driven, even though a lot of like protest songs probably gonna be politically driven. But I mean, when I say about, you know, a song about a particular issue or something like that, it could be like, man, this song just nailed exactly what I'm feeling this week and I'm going to sing it. You know, that's a great way to use a cover song where it's about the message, maybe not a song that's, you know, mega pop hit. It could still be, but maybe it's more about the message and they nailed it. And so you're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think this is not exactly related, but another use of releasing a cover song as a recording could be to set an expectation about some change in your sound. Like maybe you're going in a more electronic direction. So you do like a Postal Service cover or I don't know. For me, actually, I've been going more stripped down singer-songwriter folky. So I took a pop song by Robin and did a like very slow, depressing acoustic version of it as a way of sort of, I hope, communicating like this is the direction my own stuff will be going in as well, but like we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, I like
a way of setting expectations.
I like that idea of setting expectations. I don't think it was on my list, but it might have been somewhere. But I like the idea of like using a cover. Like if you're working on a new album, you're like, whoa, this one's going to sound very different than what came before. Using that cover to set that up, because again, you're speaking the musical language that they already know in that song, and now they can get over the idea of the song. They know the song and they can just start to soak in this new sound and have an appreciation for it, and maybe provide a little more context before the new album of originals come out and they're like, what is this? So you're going more stripped down, huh?
Well, yes and no. I've been making super stripped down songs that are just like acoustic guitar and voice. And then at the exact same time, I've sent a bunch of songs to my band out there in Oregon who are doing it all in Ableton and bunch of synths and drum sequences. And so I'm going to have two wildly different albums coming out probably next year.
I really like that single you did that sounded kind of like Muse. I'm like, this is the new direction for Chris.
Oh, the one with that repetitive bass part? Do-do-do-do-do. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Well, when we were talking about setting expectations, maybe I said if you're going in an electronic direction, maybe you do a postal service thing, but maybe it's more important that the arrangement of the song be in that direction and you can pick whatever song you want. And it'd be cooler if it was a song that wasn't originally in that context, but your new direction kind of informs how you produce.
That's what I was thinking. Like, not necessarily taking a song where it's like from that genre, but taking a song people know and doing your new sound onto it. So they know the song, like, yeah, I dig this. I dig this sound. This is cool what they did to this song. And then they get a whole album of originals. It bridges the gap there. So they've heard you do something and have an appreciation for it. And now they're open to what is coming.
It's funny how much of a difference that makes when you like give your fans just a little bit of, what's the word?
Appetizer?
Coaxing, or appetizer?
A sample?
Just that you're, yeah, like a sample, and you're including them on the change rather than just being like, oh, by the way, here's our new album now, and it's completely different from our last one, and everyone's like, oh. Whereas the exact same music, if you'd sort of kept them informed along the way that you were going in a new direction, when it comes out, the same exact people could be like, oh, this is
cool. You
know,
we actually get that question a lot on the podcast, and we've even had some of those that I think we've read recently where they're like, our old album sounds nothing like our new album. Should we keep the old album up? Yes, but do a cover in between that bridges the gap. So problem solved. So, but we
problem
do.
Solved,
I'm
going
to check that one off. We solved that problem for artists. All right. So some other reasons to do a cover, to target playlists and podcasts. It's a way for you to reach new audiences around a theme a lot of times, like cover songs. People are going expecting interesting versions of songs they know. And it's a way to go, they'll hear it just like we were talking about, like, you know, a sound, they know the song already. And it's like, oh, I like that artist. I'm gonna go check them out. So you can be very strategic. I know Lance Allen does a lot of strategic, you know, covers towards specific Spotify playlists, but there's also podcasts out there that are all about cover songs. So there's podcasts you can target that do this and playlists, lots of curated cover song collections out there on the web. So that's something that you can look for.
Well, when I did my Robin song cover, the very stripped down acoustic one, I had in mind that, oh, this will be easy to pitch to all these acoustic covers playlists that are on Spotify. And I thought that up until the moment I was actually pitching the song or looking for playlists to pitch to. And I went, and for hours and hours and hours, I realized that most of these quote acoustic covers playlists are that type of acoustic cover that's like big with the YouTubers, where like the vocals are super perfect and compressed and probably auto-tuned, but have that touch of like Glee Club, a cappella approach to the vocals, and the acoustic guitars are all really chimey. And I was like, oh, this is not what I'm doing. Like, I'm doing like Iron and Wine folk. You know, you can hear a little bit of tape hiss. Like, mine's the imperfect. So I did get it on some playlists, and it has been, you know, it stayed on those, but they were harder for me to find because I didn't realize what acoustic covers meant to most people on Spotify. You know, but as I'm describing this in a negative way, do you know that?
Oh,
kind of
absolutely.
Music I'm talking about?
I'm picturing someone sitting on their bed on a YouTube video right now playing an acoustic song cover, you know, acoustic cover, because that's what half of YouTube is. Yeah, I totally get it. I get it. And You know, they're probably wanting this mid-tempo, poppy, acoustic-driven vibe, and you did not give them that. You gave them something different.
Yeah, like even when they're covering sad songs, like you can tell they're smiling through it and they look really pretty. Yeah, not my thing.
What, looking pretty or smiling?
Both. In my music, I look pretty and smile all the time in real life.
You do. You do. You have very striking eyes, Chris.
No, I try.
It's just the mustache we need to talk about.
Okay. It's a recent development, so I'm not attached to it.
All right. Where are we here? Let's see. One thing I was going to point out, that a cover song could just be a song you like. That could be the whole reason you play it. You know what? I like this song. And that kind of plays into you as an influencer or as an artist, but it could be something, I just want to play this song. It doesn't have to be so strategic or so tied into something, but if, you know, these are just some guidelines to help you understand the value of covers and maybe think outside the box of what you've been thinking when it comes to covers. The next one I had was that it's a good way to keep new music rolling in between releases. And I know we talked about bridging the gap with your changing sound, but I mean, this could be, your band isn't changing sound, but it's like, it's been a while since we've released an album. What can we do to just keep fans engaged, that we're still here, we're still making music? Covers are a good way to get something out there. You know, doesn't have to be as high quality production as your album, but it's a way to just keep fans engaging with your music. And, you know, you can use it for some of these other opportunities like playlists and what and all that. So the next up I have is, if you want to get gigs, having a healthy catalog of covers under your belts is a good way to enhance your gig calendar, because as you were saying, Chris, some places are going to require it.
Yeah. I mean, especially early on in your like music, live music making, like those are the gigs that are probably going to pay. And if you want to make money, you're probably going to have to play cover song gigs, or gigs in which you're playing, like you say, a healthy mix of cover songs, until you're to that point where you can fill a club playing your own music.
Yeah. And a lot of those type of gigs that you mentioned, it's like they may even come with a guarantee of a certain amount of money, but they're going to say, but you got to play for 3 hours. It's hard to find an artist that, especially starting out, that has 3 hours of original music that's going to be engaging for that long anyway. So it's right. One of those things where having that amount of covers ready to go makes it easy to say yes to those gigs and have a lot of flexibility in how the night goes. You mentioned this already, but I also had in my notes, it's an amazing way to get better as a musician. It forces you to approach music in a way that maybe you wouldn't do yourself, and it expands your musical vocabulary. And, you know, that's what the Beatles did in Hamburg. They went and played covers all night long and got really good.
Yeah. And they got, not just in terms of musicianship, but their songwriting too. You can totally steal chord changes that you find, or way, you know, passing tones and any little thing you learn from a cover song, can be incorporated into your own music.
Yeah. It's a really great way to break out of a musical rut. So like, if you feel like you're not growing as a musician, that's a great way. I mean, that's what, with a lot of my practice time lately, I've been learning a bunch of other songs because I'm like, man, I feel like I'm in a rut as a guitar player and even a songwriter, and like, just go learn some other songs. It just opens your vocabulary, and it provides you with more to draw on, and it just helps out a lot.
Yeah. And we already kind of talked about this. The other thing it does is definitely stretches your memory in a good way, because like there'll be songs like, you know, Tempted by Squeeze.
Yeah.
It's a song most people have probably heard a billion times, and they probably think of it as a very simple song, but there's a trillion chord changes in that, especially in the verse. And, you know, you probably know all the chords. Maybe there's a few you have to learn, but then remembering the order they go in, because they hardly ever repeat anything. It's a cool exercise to be like, oh my gosh, this song that I've heard so often and sounds simple is really pretty complex, or at least, you know, it's challenging my memory in a new way. So I feel like that's a really, it becomes fun once you get it under your fingers.
Yes. There's a song on our new record that was like that when we were learning. It's only like four chords, but the order kept changing. And I'm like, when we were in the writing room, like trying to hash it out, it was driving me crazy because it was similar enough, but then it kept changing. I'm like, dang it. Could you guys just put them all in the same order so I don't have to think so hard?
Sometimes that's even harder when there's fewer chords, but they keep changing it strange places.
Yes.
Or in
yes.
Different variations.
And like I said, I can't keep much of them in my brain. So if it's not easy, I'm just no good. Moving on. YouTube, we mentioned that briefly a little bit, but that is a whole sort of
disparagingly
this whole sort of genre on YouTube, the acoustic cover, just like you mentioned playlist acoustic covers, but on YouTube, but not just the acoustic cover. Pomplamoose, Jack Conte from Pomplamoose has talked about many times that about how they were doing these covers on YouTube, and somebody said something about Beyonce, I forget what it was, like the Grammys or something, that like Beyonce was robbed or whatever. So everybody went to YouTube and was searching for that song, and their streams exploded because of it. So YouTube is like the number two, I think it's still the number two search engine. So it's a place where people are searching for songs, they're searching for artists, and it's a great way to show up in those searches by doing cover songs. A lot of people will do cover songs of like, they'll target freshly released hit songs. Like the second they know a big artist is releasing an album, they're listening to it and doing their own version of it, and oftentimes having it live by the end of the day. You don't necessarily have to go that extreme.
I would say, and I would say if you're on top of it to that degree and you can get this stuff out super quick, that's a great way to approach it. If you miss the boat by a few weeks, it might be kind of like, too late. There's probably already 5,000 other cover songs of that song on there, in which case maybe you think of different songs. Maybe you go for classic songs or songs that haven't been covered as much.
Yeah. And there's one of this band that was being circulated recently of them playing Sweet Child of Mine. It's like they're all in a, I can't remember if it was a recording studio or just a rehearsal room, and they're kind of like this jazzy, funky kind of band, very different take on Sweet Child of Mine. And they were obviously amazing players. Like there was a Rhodes player and a really tight, jazzy kind of funky beats. And the bass player was like going 100 miles an hour and it worked. It wasn't my favorite version of Sweet Child of Mine, but it was very cool what they did, and it got them a pretty big audience because it really showcased them as musicians with a song you already liked, like exactly what we're talking about. But that was one that was on YouTube recently. But yeah, a lot of people on YouTube are trying to target what's coming out. What are people going to be searching for? And I think with the situation with Pomplamoose, that was where they were really drawing people into who they were as musicians, because they were doing their very own unique spin on the music and people really dug it. So it's like they go searching for Beyonce, but then they find this other version of Single Ladies and they're like, whoa, this is really cool. And who are these guys? And then they dive into that band and, you know, digest more of their catalog. So that's on YouTube. There's a bit more of a game there of like trying to be quick and find the popular things that are going to hit when people are searching for them. But it's also an opportunity to collaborate with other artists. That's something that you'll see a lot with YouTubers who are doing cover songs. They'll do like a mashup or a cover song where both artists contribute something, and a way to draw each other into each other's prospective audiences. That happens a lot on YouTube.
Or that guy who makes video game music who had something like 72 collaborators. He did a medley of like all the Mario Brothers.
Oh yes.
Soundtracks. And I think there were 70 or 80 different collaborators. You know, they each got like, I don't know, 10 seconds of airtime, but
wow.
It was impressive to have stitched it all together.
That sounds like a lot of work.
And then the video I think was like 12 to 15 minutes long.
Wow. That's a long song.
But then you've got 70-something video game musicians on YouTube who all have their own fan bases sharing it with...
That's true. That's true. So the work may pay off.
Right.
I've got a couple more. The next one I was like Facebook Live. Facebook Live is a great way to live stream some cover songs. But the one thing that I was noting is that with Facebook and you're doing live streaming, I see artists where they just kind of put a camera up there. It's kind of randomly pointed and they're live streaming and, you know, whatever, that's fine. But I think the opportunity when you're in a live environment is for that as much interaction as you can have as possible. So, you know, getting on Facebook Live and doing cover songs by request, that makes it fun and interactive with your audience. And then they start trying to like throw out songs, hoping you can do them, or maybe trying to challenge you for a song that you don't already know if you're somebody that knows 1,000 songs.
I think I'm gonna do this. This sounds fun.
See, I've got ideas, Chris. But yeah, so it's something where it's like interactive and fun. And yeah, you know a lot of cover songs. So you're like, Stump Chris, we're going to play Stump Chris today. What song does Chris not know? And people will pull out cover songs or just they want to hear you play different songs. And the key being it's fun, it's lighthearted, and it's interactive. They feel like, I mean, it's funny how people interact on the web. Like we've both done live streams and been a part of webinars. And people are funny when it's like, I'm on Facebook and I typed something in and the person on Facebook talked back to me. It's like, I'm interacting with this person on TV and they're doing what I tell them to do. People kind of, they enjoy that. They like that. So that's a way to make it fun and interactive in a live environment. You can throw in your own songs too. You can ask them to, you know, whatever, but covers get fun.
Yeah, I'm gonna do that. I did have an idea once. I don't know what the limits of a Facebook Live broadcast are time-wise, but I thought one time it would be crazy and fun and ridiculous to do a Facebook Live where I play every song I know, like including all whatever 5, 6, 7 hours of my own stuff and then however 5 hours of covers or whatever it is and just do this thing that just goes on for like all day just to see like, and I'd have to take, you know, like bathroom breaks and have people bring me like things to sip on.
That's funny. I can't remember what live stream it was, but there was an artist I was watching their live stream and I clicked on it right from the beginning. And there was like a sign sitting there and it looked like they were doing just that, like taking a bathroom break. And they're like walking around in the background. I'm like, what's going on?
Back in five.
I'm here at the time they said it was going to start, but it seems like they've got other things going on. Yeah, I know you can go a couple hours. I don't remember what the exact length is, but you could go a while.
Well, it would, you know, I wouldn't expect anyone to sit through it all. It'd just be for...
To say you did it?
Just to say I did it, but...
Maybe it would be the Guinness Book of World Records longest live stream concert.
Longest, yeah. And then if I need to stretch it, I can just do some random like noise looping, whatever.
That's when it would get good. That's like when you wait till it gets really late and everyone's just bleary-eyed, like, what is Chris going to do? It becomes the Truman Show.
Yeah. Like I forget I'm broadcasting. I'm picking
my nose. That would be good. The final thing I had was just, and you mentioned at one point, like tribute bands. That's also another interesting and fun way to maybe tell something about yourself as an artist or your band. Like if you do a tribute concert to a particular band for whatever reason, it can be a fun way for you to just tell that part of your story as them as an influence. Or, you know, something, I don't know. I know in Portland, we've had a bunch of those that might relate to an artist from Portland or something like that, you know, they can be fun.
Yeah. I used to play a lot of I'm doing one for Frightened Rabbit coming up in November, but in Oregon, I used to do those sorts of things all the time. And, musically it was fun, but the other benefit is that because it's a tribute to someone generally a lot more famous than you are, the clubs are usually pretty full, and a lot of times they'd be sold out. So it's kind of like guaranteed fun night in front of a big audience.
Yeah, it's a way to broaden broaden your reach, especially if it is like everyone in the band is your band, and it's just something you're doing for fun and to reach a broader audience, it is a good way to pull people into what you're doing. So, all right. Well, I am definitely interested to hear people's thoughts on cover songs. Have you done a cover that failed miserably or worked really well? Are you still thinking covers are lame? Or tell us how you're using cover songs in your music career. Are you using them strategically or just for fun? We want to know. Call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com.
I have a quick plug for CD Baby too, and that is if you're releasing a single that's a cover song, you can license it through us. We'll take care of the mechanical licenses that you will need to distribute that cover, and we'll pay the royalties on the back end, so you don't have to, you know, worry about ongoing accounting and making payments to the songwriters and publishers for the rest of your life. We'll take care of all that for a, you know, small upfront fee.
Yeah, it's easier than ever to do cover songs. I know in years past, people would be like, well, how do I license it properly? Am I doing it right? We take care of all that. You don't have to worry about paying anything. We get the license. You're good to go. So if you've got those cover songs, it's a great time to get them out there and mess around with pitching them to playlists and all sorts of things. So yes, we make it easy. I'm hoping that we get some good cover song stories.
Yeah.
I wonder if anyone's ever been booed for cover songs.
Oh, for a cover? I'm sure, but I can't.
Well, we got thrown off the stage. That was our whole show.co thing. that show.co campaign we have running is hear the song the guy got us kicked off the stage. That was exciting. I need more.
That was, yeah. But that wasn't because no one was into it.
No, but it was because we're playing cover songs.
Right.
No, but yeah, I'd be curious if people got booed, like, that song sucks. Like you're out of...
Or that song's amazing and you just ruined it.
Yeah.
How dare you?
How dare you? Anyway, we'd love to hear your stories on that. We've got some emails, so let's jump into that now. This one relates to our last episode where I used the audio from the 2018 DIY Musician Conference, the session about touring Europe without a label. Here it goes. Hey there, as a European artist starting to tour Europe, I really digged that episode about touring in Europe. One thing about mobile data in Europe that might be interesting to your audience. Since mid-2017, you basically can buy a prepaid SIM card anywhere in Europe and use that in most of the EU countries. Disclaimer, you need to revisit the country you've purchased the card every 3 months, and not all of Europe is actually part of the EU. The deals for data and calls are really different across Europe, and I don't feel confident recommending a specific carrier. But if you search for good value deals, it should set you up with enough data so that you can keep up with your Instagram feeds or whatever for maybe $20 a month. Thanks for the show. Really dig it. My band is called Absalom Max. We play acoustic soul. Hope to see you at the European conference. Cheers, Hans. That's a good tip, because that's one thing that's when you go to Europe, like I go there for work occasionally and I'm only there for, you know, 5 days, and it charges me $10 a day to have my same plan, which, you know, if I'm there for work, I just charge CD Baby for. But if I was going to be there for a 3 month tour, that would add up to being $300 a day, and I'm not going to pay that. So that's a good tip that you could go get a SIM card.
$300 a month.
Oh yeah, $300 a month. I'm not going to pay $300 a month as an artist to go on tour, but having a SIM card, just go pick up a SIM card and $20 a month. That's no big deal. So thanks for the tip, Hans. Moving on. This is from Renee. Hi, it would seem that as streaming services are becoming the preferred way for people to listen to music, while artists would like to sell their music, isn't it counterproductive to immediately put new music on Spotify when trying to sell tracks, CDs? I think that it is smarter to first distribute the music through the usual aggregators, through CD Baby, iTunes, Amazon, CD Universe, and let the release go through its life cycle on sales, and then make it available on streaming services once sales have slowed. And he is in Prague. Very European today. Renee is in Prague. I responded to him by email, but what is your take, Chris?
Well, probably not surprisingly, I think it's a bad idea to window your music in such a way. I think you should make it available everywhere at once. You know, I shouldn't say this as a blanket statement. It differs based on, you know, your relationship with your fans and where you're at. But generally, you're going to have all types of listeners. You'll have very casual listeners who are not going to buy your CD no matter what. In which case, do you really want them to not hear your music? No, you want them to hear your music still, I think. And then you'll have these sort of middle tier ones who need to investigate enough before they want to purchase. And then you'll have your fans who are ready to buy right away and who will probably still also want it on Spotify. Every single album that I've purchased physically in the past few years, I've also listened to a ton on Spotify. I've listened to it more on Spotify than I've actually listened to the physical media. So don't punish your fans by keeping it off of those platforms. All that to say, at the same time, the value of your physical media should be more than just, okay, it's $12 of plastic, like, or whatever it's made of. You need to make the experience of getting that thing worth more than just what it is at face value. And I think if you do, you won't have any trouble still getting your dedicated fans to purchase something, even if they never undo the shrink wrap and put it in their CD player. Cause it's about something more than the media. That's what I would
agreed.
Say.
I basically told him the same thing, that one, I don't know his music and the style or his fans, that there are some genres where the fans might still prefer CD, but you should never, cut certain people out of the equation. I'm a Spotify subscriber. If you give me something that's not a Spotify link, I'm probably just going to not listen to it, because why am I going to go find it on Amazon? Or, you know, it's just, I know the frustration of artists that used to sell a ton of CDs and now streams don't seem to amount as much for the same effort for some, not across the board, but I'll say for some. You've got to start with how fans are engaging with music and then work from there. You can't start from the, I used to make money selling these plastic things and the fans don't want them anymore, but I still want them to buy these plastic things because I make more money. You can't start from there unless, like you said, you're making it more valuable or more collectible or something that adds to the experience. So in general, you can't say, okay, so then everyone who doesn't want it on this plastic thing now doesn't get to enjoy the music.
Can't have it.
That's just the reality of it. I mean, it's always been, you know, what the fans want, how they want to engage with the music. Even when CDs reigned supreme, it was really that was just a distribution method, that the files were on a plastic disc. Well, we don't need to transport music files that way anymore because we can stream them. So that whole world isn't necessarily the way most people are going to engage with music. I basically told him a lot of what you said, and that, yes, it's great if you have fans that want to buy CDs and you should absolutely make them aware of it. But, you know, the best you can do as an artist is to get the most amount of people talking about your music at the same time, because all these platforms have algorithms that turn that into activity and data that causes more activity. And so really just trickling it out when you could have a big impact all at once, I'll take the big impact.
Yeah. And I know I already said this when I was giving my answer, but I think that instead of having like a real protectionist attitude about things, think more about, okay, those people who are your best customers or your best fans that are following your directions and going through the experience of buying your CD, give them the world. Like, make sure they can also, like I do, stream these things on Spotify. Make it about like giving those people everything. And if you're giving them everything, it also means you've got to be on the places that where they already probably subscribe to get music.
Agreed.
And everyone else that's streaming your stuff for, you know, fractions of a penny at a time, all the better, because that's activity and that'll help you grow in a different
way.
And
this also plays into what I've been saying a lot on the podcast and just in conversations in general, that we've moved from a buying economy to a playing economy. Your job as an artist is no longer to get people to buy stuff. It's to get them to listen to it, which to me is a much better position to be in for an artist, because we never wanted to be salesmen in the first place. That's why we started playing our instruments, because we didn't want to go sell stuff to people. All right, we've got two more emails, so we're going to keep rolling. This is from Hayden. Hey, guys. First off, I love the show. It's very entertaining, and I love all the creative insight and all the creative insight that you all share. My name is Hayden, and I'm the vocalist for a fairly new metal band called Citadels. Everything is going great. We just tracked our first single, and we'll be releasing it within the month and plan to track a 5-song EP. I'm also a college student, and while I'm so passionate about this band and the music, and I feel that I play a pretty big role in the songwriting, I'm planning to study abroad for 4 months in the spring in Rome. I feel that this experience is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that I can't pass up, but I just hate the timing of it. I've shared this info already with my bandmates, and they still want me to be in the band. Is there any possible advice y'all could give me on how we could still be productive while I'm gone? Thanks, Hayden. So far, 3 emails, and they all had something to do with Europe.
Yeah. First, I would say go. 4 months isn't a long time. In the grand scheme of things, I know when you're just thinking about putting out music or trying to promote something, that can be a long time, but don't let it stop this grand adventure. And yes, you could be doing so many things. You could be doing, did he say that there's music that's been released?
They just tracked their first single and we'll be releasing it within a month and are planning to track a 5-song EP.
Before he leaves?
That's he doesn't specifically say, but that would be my assumption.
I mean, in a way, it could be perfect. If that's all tracked by the time he leaves, the next 4 months is artwork, promotion, manufacturing, making videos, getting, any kind of PR you're doing. Like, it seems like a good window where you shift in a way away from the creative stuff anyways and get more into the creative marketing side of things. So,
yeah, to me, when I read it, I'm like, 4 months really isn't that long. I know if he's in college, sometimes 4 months seems like an eternity. But as you get older, 4 months, it's like feels like a week. 4 months isn't that long. But one, absolutely, absolutely, you should take that opportunity because it will be life changing, regardless of music. Going and living in a foreign country for 4 months, you will have a new perspective on the world that will influence everything in your life. And it'll be worth it. 4 months isn't that long. Similar to what Chris was saying, I was thinking like if you get it released before he leaves and they film a bunch of video content and they have photos and they have, if they've got a couple shows they film or even just live stuff that they or like rehearsals that they track that they can get good recordings on video. That while he's gone, the album comes out right before he leaves and they really spend a lot of time just letting that content roll afterwards and start planning the tour when he gets back. So their new band, the music's getting out there, they're building a buzz and they start booking for when he gets back because that's going to be about the time frame that they're going to need to be looking towards anyway to get shows is like 4 months, 6 months out in the future. So it really could be something that goes by really fast and you feel like you've accomplished a lot while you're away. And the other thing is it's super easy to exchange files and write songs over the internet. I mean, that's what I do with Small Town Poets. We just send files back and forth. I'll track some ideas. I'll send it back. They'll track some ideas. And so you can be productive, start planning set lists, maybe a list of cover songs to be learning. There's lots you can be doing that I think will make the time go by quickly, but also you'll feel very productive and less disconnected. Having to check in with them like once a week or every other week is also a good idea to just keep talking through ideas.
Yeah. And I don't know how big their following is at this point, but it might be worth trying at least once to see how it goes. There's third party platforms you can use to host a sort of interview style conversation on Facebook Live, or, you know, you could do YouTube Live and do that sort of thing. And do like a check-in with your band where you tell them about your life in, where is he going? Rome. Yeah. Talk about living it up in Italy. And then your band can tell you what it's like back here and what they've got in the works. And like, just like let your fans in on the on the conversation in a way. It might be interesting and maybe they like it and you make a weekly thing out of it.
Yeah, you almost make it like a where in Rome is Hayden now?
And yeah, I mean, if you did it on your phone, you could even, if they host it here, you know, if they're the ones hosting the broadcast, you can be on your phone and look around. Hey, there's the Colosseum or whatever.
Yeah. Or make it some other storyline. Like, we sent Hayden to Rome to find the best pizza. For the next 4 months, we're going to follow him eating pizza all around Rome. Right. And just make it some sort of thing.
I like
pizza, the best pizza, beer, and band. So he's going to go look for the best three of those that he could find, or best of those he can find in Rome while he's there. And we're going to keep checking in with him. Yeah, see, there's lots of things you can do that are fun that keep people engaged and bring it into the story of the band and not like you're feeling like you have to hide. We're not doing anything because nobody cares that you're going to be not playing shows for 4 months. It's a matter of like acknowledging it and bringing people along for the ride is the best way to go.
And I am just now remembering, though, like when I was first out of college and we had a band, we just moved to Oregon. And the drummer was like, oh, I got to fly back to Mississippi for, 2 weeks or whatever. And me and the bass player would be like, 2 weeks? You can't be gone that long.
Where's your dedication to the band?
Yeah, I know. Like, we got practice, man. We're supposed to be getting ready for a recording. And he's just like, yeah, I'm going to miss two practices and then I'll be back. And to us, it was a huge deal. It felt like almost like a betrayal, or he wasn't committed. But looking back, that was very foolish and narcissistic of us. And I think, but given that maybe that's the age you guys are at, maybe it's important for you to make an extra effort to let the rest of your band know that you're still like in it. You're going to be working in whatever capacity you can. You're still keeping the communication open. When you get back, you're psyched to like dive back in fully. I think it's good to address all that as well. So not like we're totally discounting this thing by saying 4 months is nothing.
Yeah, agreed. Just, and when you're in college, 4 months feels like a long time. There's a lot of things that are still happening in your life that are changing very rapidly. So that's why 4 months feels like a huge chunk of time at that point, where later in life, it doesn't feel as long. And we've got one more email. This one, they've all been great. So thank you for all the emails. Hey, Kevin and Chris, I love your podcast and find it extremely helpful in two ways. One, educational. I learn new tips and tricks. Two, validation that I do actually know what I'm doing. I do artist management for The Colonel, The Minx, and Slow Parade. And he put a link where you can hear more of these artists on his Small Fry Spotify playlist. In episode 217, you had a caller ask about ways to simplify the concert aggregators, Bands in Town, and Songkick. I don't have a one-stop silver bullet solution for these, but have figured out a way to streamline them for my artist. I created tour show logs using Excel for my artists that we use to both help plan, plot future tours, but also once they're confirmed, we use them to track other key details, venue, contact information, supporting acts, payouts, notes, etc. It's some work, but good for tracking and historical purposes as well. Turns out, with a few small modifications to the Excel log I created, I can do a bulk import into both Bands in Town and Songkick. This way, you don't have to go to each and hand jam them in. It's really easy, and so far has been very little issues importing shows to both platforms. In fact, I did it yesterday for The Colonel, and he gave me a link to the show list for that he imported. And he said, if it's something you're interested in, he's happy to share more details. That might be a good blog post, Chris.
I think it is.
His name is Josh. Yeah, I'll send you his email.
Send me his email.
That would be a good blog post because I thought that was useful. You could create a spreadsheet, especially if you have multiple shows that you have lined up and you need to upload. It's easier to type stuff into an Excel doc than and just upload it once. And then you have it for your records and it's online.
Right. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So thanks for all those emails. Lots of great stuff. Good questions. Interesting tips. If you'd like to email us, it's podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or call the listener line at 360-524-2209.
No, there was no calls today, right? They all emails?
No calls that I played.
And the other ones were indecipherable?
Yes, we'll say that. I'm going to say yes to that. Okay. Yeah, if you want to call in, it's best if you have your thoughts prepared or you keep it brief. Those are the two tips that I have. I really don't like editing people's calls, mainly because I don't want to change what you've said and make any judgments on the context and your point. So typically if a call gets a little rambly and hard to follow, I don't use it. Or if it's just really, really long, I don't use it typically either. Sometimes it gets cut off. I think it lasts for like 2 minutes. I think you have a 2 minute timer once you start talking. So it's good to have it prepared, but I love calls, but none this week.
Cool. Well, hopefully we'll have some cover song calls.
Yes. I'm curious to hear because I was very shocked at that meetup when that person got that angry at me for mentioning the idea of doing a cover song. It was like their whole demeanor changed. They stood up. They kind of not shouted at me. I don't want to make it like they assaulted me. But again, I was a few vodka sodas in. I wouldn't care.
I mean, they think you're asking them to be what they consider part of the problem.
That's exactly what it was.
You just want me to make more noise that's appealing to some bubblegum person who doesn't have the intelligence or whatever to listen to my original thing and
I got the I'm a real artist line, so.
Yeah. Okay, great. So keep being a real artist.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
You don't have to do covers.
Yeah. That you don't. Nope, you don't. You absolutely do.
Or
not.
You can be a real artist that does covers. Yeah. Your choice.
Yeah. Well, it was just the reaction was entertaining. But, you know, everybody, you're more than free to do your own thing. But if you're going to ask me for advice on how to get some fans, I might say do some cover songs. It doesn't mean I don't think you're any good.
How dare you answer my question?
Anyway, this has been the last podcast at 13909 Airport Way. The old CD, the second CD Baby HQ, and we're moving on. And that's I've got strong feelings in both directions. It's the new place is so nice, but it's going to take a while for us to put that CD Baby grunge on it.
Right.
With spilled coffee everywhere. And, you know, it's just interesting.
Well, I mean, and thinking of the place we were at before, the one that you're still broadcasting from right now, it's quite the evolution this company's gone.
Yes.
Through.
And we've been there for it all. It's lots of memories. Lots of people have come and gone that, have played a role in this, and you and I are still here.
Yeah.
And they built me a podcast room and I didn't even ask for it. So there we go.
Random, somewhat related story. I guess so that means it's not that random. Bradford Loomis.
Yes.
You remember him? So he was touring through Maine, and this is someone that I hung out with in Nashville, and he stopped by and on his way driving back to Nashville, and he was asking me how much of your time at work is the podcast, like, and I don't know exactly what he meant by it, but I took it to mean he thought it was like you know a decent chunk of our work, and I'm like, it's like an hour a week or however long it takes us to record it. I don't know if he was surprised or not, but just to remind everyone, this isn't our job.
Usually if you hit me up online on a Friday night, I'm probably editing the podcast, or on a Saturday morning, I'm probably at the coffee shop editing the podcast. So, it's something that, you know, it's been a labor of love. It's something that, you know, being a part of the artist community, is something that I appreciate most about my job here at CD Baby. And it's something that, even though it is not really my job to, my job title is not podcast host. It's, you know, we do marketing, but to me, this is the.
I shouldn't say it's not our job. It's a part of the community, and it's very. It's just in terms of the bulk of your sort of your weekly workload.
Yes.
It's.
Yeah, but being a part of doing the podcast and all the relationships we've built with artists through the podcast has been my favorite thing working here. So now I'm going to do it from a new spot. And I still don't know where you'll be, but you'll be, assume, in Maine, maybe on the beach in Mexico. But yeah.
And then I'll come visit the new offices once you're all moved in.
Yeah.
The Wi-Fi works and all that. So,
all right. Well, I think that's going to do it. I will post photos of the new digs once we get settled, and the next podcast, that's where we'll be at. So thanks for listening, and we'll catch you later.
See ya.
Been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.